So thanks a lot for the invitation. I'm having a very, very nice time here. It's very exciting to see all these new developments. And so I'm going to tell you a tale here. Actually, it's slightly related to machine learning, but only slightly. And I try to relate a little bit. So it's something that we started some 10 years ago. It's a project I have with Olivier Parcollet. And the main actor for what I'm going to tell today is Uriel Nunez Fernandez, that was postdoc with me. So when we started the technique that I will discuss today was known as a diagrammatic Monte Carlo. And very soon we got rid of the diagrams. Actually, I use the word Feynman diagrams, but there are no diagrams anymore, strictly speaking. And very recently we also got rid of the Monte Carlo. So we are looking for a new name now. And so that's the second part I'm going to discuss mostly today. So this is my very naive view of what is machine learning. Okay, extremely naive. So you have data, you have a model. More often than not, it's a neural network. You have a cost function, you optimize it, and then you use it for whatever purpose. So today I'm going to use, instead of a neural network or anything else, I'm going to use a tensor network, actually a tensor train, which is, you could say it's a model, but it's a model that is highly structured, as opposed to a neural network, which are, you know, essentially totally agnostic to what you can give them. These tensor networks will actually be very efficient if the initial problem that you are looking at has some structure, is low rank in some sense that I will define. So that makes it less universal in some sense. On the other hand, when it works, it is extremely efficient. So that's the first difference with regular machine learning. And the second is that, I will be in the framework of active learning, which means that I have an object, will be a function of many variables, which I can compute. It's on my computer. I wrote some kind of code to actually compute this object. And I can request it for any input I want. And the algorithm will get actually good use of that. I not get some data that I have to deal with, and you know, that's it. No, I will actually request the most important data for me in order for the training to be as fast as possible. That will be the, and that's the only two connection I have with machine learning, I'm afraid. So here is the menu for today. So first, I have some sort of crash course on tensor trains or matrix product state. It's the same thing, it's just two names. So very quickly. And then I will describe this tensor cross interpolation algorithm that I am not responsible for. The guys responsible for it are Seledet and Dolgov and Savostyanov. So two mass people, I mean, or three mass people. And it's an algorithm I discovered like some 3 years ago. And so we started to use it for one task. And now it's just everywhere in my lab. Every single problem that we were looking at, we are not just putting tensor trains there and using TCI. And so it's very universal. It can be used for tons of things. So I'm going to explain you in detail how it works. More likely than not, some of you will be using it in the next months. It's very recent. I mean, the papers are a few years old, but it didn't percolate yet to the physics community. So I mean, you start to see the first papers only recently in physics. Then I'm just going to tell you how we can use this guy, TCI, to calculate Feynman diagrams. That will be the bulk of the talk. And then hopefully I will show you some physics that we managed to do with these new techniques that we couldn't do with the previous version. So let me start with tensor trains, tensor networks first. So a tensor for me is just, essentially if you have one index, it's a vector. If you have two index, it's a matrix. If you have more than two index, you need to give a different name, so it's a tensor. And it's kind of the generalization of linear algebra to objects that have more than two indices. So you can contract them. For instance, if you contract these two, so usually you will make drawings like that. It means that you sum over this internal leg here. So it's essentially this formula. So it's a direct generalization of matrix-matrix multiplication. Another common thing you can do with them, you can group and degroup indices. So it's very simple. You just take two indices, and you make one big index that actually span all the values of these two guys. You can make the same for the two others, and then you map this four index guy into a matrix. Then you have a matrix, you can use all the stuff that you have on linear algebra, do an SVD, LU decomposition, whatever you want, and then you go back to degroup the index, and that's it, you have done something on your tensors. So for instance, you can use that for compression. Let's say you have a four-leg tensor. You group it into two, these two guys together, these two guys together, that give you a matrix. You do singular value decomposition. Yesterday we had principal component analysis. It's exactly the same thing. So which means that you write this as a product of unitary matrix, a diagonal matrix, and another unitary matrix. You can truncate this guy and keep only the most important singular values, and that gives you the best approximate row rank tensor that you can get from this guy. So this is used widely in tensor train techniques. On the most, I would say the most famous and the most popular tensor train, and the one I will focus on today, is it's tensor train or matrix product state. This is how we know it in physics, and this is how the math people call it. So essentially, you write if you have like a many body wave function and you write it like this, it amounts to this expression. Essentially, it's a product of matrices, and each matrix depends on one index, which is a physical index here, right? And so this is so. On if you can do that, you can always do this mapping. But if you can do it and keep the dimension of the bond here that links these two guys together very low, then you have a very efficient representation of your many-body states. So this is all very well known. It has been used for the last probably 30 years or more. Maybe not with this terminology, but this MEMPS terminology is a bit more recent, but it's been used forever. You can use this toolbox for, so MPS for the state, MPO for the operators when you have like input and output legs. You can solve, for instance, linear problems. You can do, so the original DMRG algorithm from Steve White was actually for getting the eigen energies and eigen state. You can calculate overlaps between two states. You can do tons of things. There is a big toolbox. And we have Miles in the room. And if you want to know more, you can ask him, or you can check his library, iTensor. So there are tons of things that you can do once you have mapped a problem to MPS. The new brick that I'm going to discuss today is this algorithm TCI that allows you to just take anything and map it onto a tensor train. And then if this anything is low rank, then you will have something that will converge quickly. If not, then OK, maybe you should better use another technique. But at least you can try, and it's very, very quick, and it's really a black box technique. So TCI. So let me first introduce something for just matrices. It's called cross interpolation. If you want to compress a matrix into a low rank matrix, the most well-known technique is SVD, singular value decomposition. Here it's kind of the dual. It's another technique. It has an advantage that you don't need necessarily to know the full matrix. You can actually use only part of the matrix to calculate the cross interpolation. The approximation itself is given just by slices of the original matrix. And that's very important. And somehow, SVD somehow is the optimum decomposition in terms of the L2 norm. And this is the optimum decomposition in terms of the L-infinite norm. So this is, in that sense, that it is dual to SVD. And so you start with writing your matrix A as A minus 1 A. So it looks kind of dumb. But what you really do is the following, is that you write it as A minus N, 1, A, but you only take a few rows and columns in the interior here. So you select a few rows here in Salmon or whatever color I used, and a few columns here. And you write your matrix approximation as you take all the columns times the invert of what we call the pivot matrix, so this essentially whatever lies at the intersection, times all the rows. Right, so this J here means a subset of the columns, and the I here a subset of the rows. And when I use this big letter here, it means just I just take all the rows and columns. So this is some sort of MATLAB notation, if you want. And so cross interpolation has two very nice properties. So first, it's an interpolation, and that's trivial. If you evaluate this on the rows and columns, for instance, if I put here this curvy I, then I have ij minus 1, so this cancel, and I get the correct thing. So it's an interpolation. So it's always good on the pivot that you get. But the most important one is that if the matrix is rank chi, and you use a rank chi approximation, you get an exact approximation. It's not an approximation, actually, it's exact. And that's really the, so if you have a low rank matrix, you get something exact. By just taking slices, you see here, this is entirely made of rows and columns of the original matrix. I don't even need to know the rest of the matrix. I can actually do it in principle by just some part of it. And in some cases, actually, we don't explore the full matrix. This is just an example. So my student Matthew just picked up this matrix, but you could pick up any other. Just I don't know why he chose this one. And you have the error when you put one pivot. So you see the error is zero on the row and column of the pivot I chose by construction. And otherwise, it's pretty high here of order one. And then you put a second pivot. And the way we choose the second pivot is just to look at where the error is the worst. So we take the biggest error, because you know that after we put the pivot, it will be equal to zero. So we are making good use of the information. And this is in that sense that it is active learning. And then the third pivot, you see already I have in the 10 to minus 4 here background, and then 10 to minus 6, and very quickly it converges if the initial matrix is low rank. OK, so that's the cross-interpolation. So it's just something to, it's a formula to give you an approximation of a low-rank matrix. Now we are going to extend that to tensors. So I have a tensor, A. And the first thing, I'm going to describe you a toy algorithm. We don't do it like that, but just I think it helps to have this picture. So the first thing you do is you group these four indices together, and this one, U1, just is alone. So that gives you a matrix, and then you do cross interpolation of this. So that's it. I get the first row. So I have now, this is my pivot matrix. And you see that now my pivots here are a bunch of values of U2, U3, U4, U5. So it's a list of lists if you want to have the list of pivots. Well, that's bookkeeping when you write the code, you have to be a bit careful. And then I have this remaining part here, and I can do a cross interpolation of this remaining part by just putting U2 on one side and U3, U4, U5 on the other side. And I continue all the way until I have factorized the entire matrix. So I can always do that. Now the question is whether I can have a lower enough rank here for this to be useful. If you do it this way, you need actually to, you need to have the full matrix here, the full tensor without one leg to do. So this is actually very expensive. So the way we do it in practice is the following. We just write a rank one approximation. So we just get one pivot here, and we split it into n ways. So you just split it into, let's say for instance, here you will put all the variables but U1, and here U1, and here you put all the variables but U1 and U2, here U1, U2, and so on and so forth. You split it like that. And that gives you a rank one approximation of your tensor train. And then you just pick up, you sweep over pairs of T tensors here, so the T tensors are those ones. And when you are on one, you say this is an approximation of this object. An approximation of this object, where here this I is some I3, and here this is some J6. So it's again a slice of my initial tensor. And I can use cross interpolation for this slice by grouping this guy together, and this guy and that guy together, and add more pivots here. And I do that all the way. I sweep and I add pivots each time. But actually the old way, I say old version here because we have better way to do it now, but essentially that's the idea. And you can find it in this paper, or you can actually read the, we have more also detailed explanation of how it works in the paper. That's it. You know TCI? Now we can just try to see how we can use it for real world. Ah, no, actually, before we do, okay, I have one kind of trivial application. It's called quantics. So you have, say you have a function of two variables, x and y, and you want, and this function maybe has a lot of features, like you, so you need a big grid. So you can, so what you can do is you can discretize x on 2 to the power n points, and same for y. So you write x as x1 over 2 plus x2 over 4 plus x3, where the x1, x2, x3, x4 are just binary variables. So now, when I have done that, I've done this discretization, I have 2 to the n variables for each dimension. And typically, we went, I mean, you can go up to 1,000 billion points if you want, or more. I mean, it really doesn't matter. And so now when you've done this discretization, you have this big tensor with two n indices. And then you run TCI on it, and you see what you get. So rank 1 is not so good, rank 5, rank 10. And rank 20 already, you see it's close to the exact thing. And then you have rank 40, which is almost exact, or probably exact actually at this stage. So that's quantics. It allows you to map 2D functions, 3D functions, I mean a low-D function, but with arbitrary high resolution, and you can use it for tons of things. Actually, something funny about this, if you do a Fourier transform on this variable in quantics representation, it's a quantum Fourier transform of quantum algorithm that you use in quantum computing. A nice cat could tell you much more about this, actually. Okay, so I'm done with the first part. Now we're going to try to find a real application of this thing. So just to give you a bit of context, in my lab, so I'm a quantum nanoelectronic guy. That's really my background. So essentially, I want to solve many body problems, but I want to solve it out of equilibrium, so it's even tougher. And we have developed a bunch of tools. So there is a quant that we developed with our Delft friends. Essentially, you can give it any non-interacting problem. And it will give you the conductance, local density of state, the Green function, or stuff like that. Then we generalize it to time-dependent problems. So it's called T-quant, because T from time-dependent. And we could do also a lot of physics there. But then at some point, you need to introduce electron-electron interaction. If only, you know, even simple things like Coulomb blockade or, I mean, here's a bunch of things that we want to simulate. We want to have the things working for which are beyond mean field. You can do mean field here, but these things are beyond mean field. So the approach, just two slides on quant and T-quant, just to say that it's very general. This is example of quant. You can do veil semi-metal, quantum Hall effect, graphene, superconductivity. This is a topological insulator, off-scatter butterfly, obviously, on more on T-quant. This is a multiple Andreev reflection in Josephson junction, quantum Hall effect, a pulse actually traveling in quantum Hall effect. This is a Majorana bound state. And, okay, so a bunch of things, all with one framework and with very simple very simple interface. Okay, now we want to switch on interaction. And so the approach we took is actually extremely dumb. Actually, dumber than that, you cannot make it. We essentially did a systematic expansion in power of the interaction. And so it gives you tons of Feynman diagrams. So you can say you have solved the problem. I mean, you get the full solution, except that you have something which is maybe even worse. You get a factorial n diagrams, and each diagram is an n-dimensional integral for order n calculation. So you have three problems to solve. First one is that there are factorial n diagrams, and this is just too much. So we need to do something to lower this count. And we have a way to go from factorial n to 2 to the power n, which is, okay, still exponential, but really not as bad. I mean, for order 10, for instance, all the diagrams up to order 10 is 2 to the 10 is 1,000, as compared to factorial 10, which is more than 1 billion. Then the second problem is how to do the integrals, and this is where TCI will actually come into play. And then there is a last problem, which I will almost not discuss today, which is once you have the coefficients here, you need to reconstruct the function on the left. And actually, it's not necessarily simple, especially when these guys are the finite radius of convergence. But I will actually bypass this, especially since with a new technique, actually, we are working in a regime where everything is convergent. And this, just as a teaser, this is kind of the result we could get before we had TCI. So here you have the local density of state. So essentially, if you put a scanning tunneling microscope tip on top of your Coulomb, I forgot to say what was the problem. So we are looking at a quantum dot. So it's Anderson impurity. So you have a quantum dot within two leads described by this Hamiltonian. Epsilon d is the voltage that you apply to actually shift the level of the dot. And you have electron-electron interaction, which is the tough part here. Without interaction, you get essentially one resonance in this model. And when you switch on interaction, you see this resonance is going to be pinned at zero energy, so at the Fermi level, and get very thin. And this thin thing here is a Kondo peak. On the switch, it's a Kondo energy, which is really an emerging correlated energy in the problem, so it's not totally trivial to get that. And this is a side about Hubbard bounds, essentially, like correspond to Coulomb blockade. You know. So we could get that, but we could only get that when this detuning here was a little small, essentially. Here we could not get it, we had too much sign problem, and this was actually very costly in terms of computing time. But we could also do it in out of equilibrium. I will help you. So you put a bias voltage, you split the peaks on the on these things. When we got it, we were the only technique that actually could get these kind of things. Okay. So first problem. So we are going to. So this is my one slide explaining Keldysh formalism for you. Keldysh is something that some people afraid of Keldysh for some time. But it's actually much simpler than it looks. It's actually, I think, very simple. You start from a ground state without interaction, and you switch on interaction at t equals zero, and then you evolve with an evolution operator. And what you want to calculate is some observable later. So what you want to calculate is really average of psi on the left, which is just u dagger here with respect to whatever you added at t equals zero. So you want to calculate expectation value of the kind ut zero observable u dagger. And then what we are going to do is we work in interaction representation. So here, this u only contains interaction part of the Hamiltonian. And I want to expand in power of this Hamiltonian here. And now since I have here u and u dagger, I just have to keep track when I expand. There will be some term on the right and some term on the left. So very often you see this contour, Keldysh contour thing with drawings like this. And this is just a fancy way to just do the bookkeeping of which term come before and which term come after, because I have two u's. And that's really it. And so Keldysh is nothing fancy. And it's much more natural than the Matsubara technique or zero temperature technique. But it's slightly more cumbersome to do calculation later because you have this extra Keldysh index that tells you whether you are below or after. So the next thing we do is to expand in power of interaction here. And when I do that, I get a bunch of C daggers C that I have to average. And then I use Wick's theorem, and I get some of the old permutation of stuff like that. And then you can identify each of these permutations with a Feynman diagram, and then start to do what has been done in quantum field theory for ages, which is identify classes of diagrams and maybe find a small parameter to say which one are going to survive. And you can, there are generations of people that have worked on that. But if you have a numerical point of view, and you look at this guy in the eye, you realize that this is actually a determinant. This is nothing but determinant of the matrix C dagger I C J. Just look at it, that's the definition of a determinant. On the determinant, you don't have to have factorial n terms to calculate it. You can calculate it in n cube, right? And so that's much faster. And this is the route we are taking to essentially get rid of all the diagrams and get all of them grouped together. So if you just do it like that, it won't work because you get all the diagrams, including the disconnected diagrams, which are going to behave very badly when you try to integrate them. So the real trick here, and I'm not going to spend much time on that, is that when you do this summation over the Keldysh indices, of, remember, below and after the observable, that is automatically kill the disconnected diagram, and then you get something that behaves very well. So at the end of the day, we get a big integral like this to calculate, n-dimensional integral for calculation of order n, of sum of determinant of Green function of the non-intacting problem. And it's ugly, but at the end, on the other hand, it's on the right hand side, I have just a non-interacting Green function, and I spent like years to develop stuff to calculate those. And so I can calculate this guy, and then I just need to find a good way to calculate the integral. And just to say one more about disconnected diagrams, if you don't do the sum over Keldysh here, you get stuff like that. This is order 2 integrant as function of the two variables, u1 and u2. And blue means negative, red positive. So you see they are almost of the same order, they almost compensate. So when you do the sum over these four guys, you get something which is much smaller. I didn't put the scale, but the scale is about 10 times smaller than this. And also that don't oscillate anymore, and this is the object on which we work. Okay, I come to TCI now. So we want to calculate n-dimensional integrals. So we know how to compute this guy, and we just need to integrate. And before we were doing that in Monte Carlo, I mean, okay, I don't need to tell you that the n-dimensional integral is, you get the dimensionality curse, so it's tough if you want to do it brute force. And so essentially, actually the idea that we, when we started this business, wanted to do some machine learning, because when you do Monte Carlo, you call this guy about a billion times, but each time you call it as if you knew nothing about it. So the initial idea of the project was actually to learn this integrand, and we thought it could maybe help us to actually make the sampling faster or things like that. And actually, we got rid of that entirely. And also, a big problem of Monte Carlo is that it works very well when the quantity you want to integrate is positive, but if it starts to oscillate, then the variance is increasing very, very quickly. This is known as a sign problem. Okay, but now we have this guy, we give it to TCI, and if we are lucky, we get a bunch of matrices at the end, so this guy essentially factorized. And if you really think of it as a function, this is a just many dimension function, it's just a generalization of when you have separation of variables, except that now it's slightly more complex separation of variables because these guys are matrices. But if you have this, then you just can integrate each of them separately, and then you need to do a bunch of matrix vector multiplication, and you get the integral. That's it. The integral is given. If you have TCI, the integral is free. And this is the result that we get. So first, this is like a snapshot of the integrand that we are looking at for order 10 calculation. So you have the exact thing is the red. And this is just going, one variable is actually going through the other ones. And you see it's kind of ugly, they are cusped, it's actually, it's positive and negative, it oscillates, but the TCI approximation is very, very good. You get extremely fast convergence, so this is actually for the full final integral in a case where we have a benchmark like with beta on that, and you get a very, very fast 1 over n square convergence. The best you can hope with Monte Carlo is actually the best and the worst you can hope with Monte Carlo is 1 over square root of n, which is this slope, but usually the prefactor is actually very big, so you get something like this. It's almost impossible to get more than 2 digits. And here, actually, we went to machine precision, essentially. And the most important thing for me are the two curves on the right. This is the sign of the integral. So it's integral of the integrand divided by integral of the absolute value of the integrand. So if you have no oscillations, no sign problem, this guy is equal to 1, and which is the case here close to epsilon d here equals 0. Epsilon d, again, is the gate voltage on my Coulombic gate. And here, this is the regime where I could calculate before in Monte Carlo. But now here, you see it's going to 10 to minus 5. And if you have a sign which is 10 to minus 5, it means that you increase your computing time by 10 to the power 10 in Monte Carlo, which means that this guy is totally out of scope, but like by so many orders of magnitude that I don't even want to think about it. And that's the error we get from TCI for a fixed budget of computation. It's flat. It doesn't care. It doesn't care at all whether these things oscillate or not. So it doesn't mean it will always work, but at least the reason for which it works or doesn't has nothing to do with the reason for which Monte Carlo works or doesn't work. And so it means that it can be tried for tons of things. It's really agnostic to sign problem. And okay, maybe I will. Okay, we went up to order 30 before we could do 12 or so. We get again this precision in this kind of area. Order 10 now is 17 seconds on one core. Before it was like overnight on the cluster kind of things. So it's really for us, it's a magic improvement. And also you get the integral as a post-processing step, so it's free. And so you can, for instance, in this guy, we get the full stuff as a function of time, as post-processing. So essentially I can just decide on my boundary of integration as post-processing, so I can get the full curve. For free. I could also change a bit my Hamiltonian, say the way I switch on interaction could be slow or fast, this is what we did here. And also it's post-processing, it's free. So there are many things you can do for free when you get the TCI approximation. On this one I love. On the blue curve we did the regular TCI. And you see that to get the correct result, you need to go to order, let's say, 12 times 12 or so. That's typical time it takes to converge to the current state. On the orange one, what we did is, okay, we went up to here, up to 2, and we did all the learning between time between 0 and 2. And then we did, once we have the learning, we did the integral up to 12. And you see that here, so by just learning by essentially 0 to 2, so it's a very, very, very tiny fraction of the configuration space, it's able to get the correct stuff with 4 or 5 digits. And that means that there is, it's really about low rank, and you don't even, if it is low rank, you don't even need to look at the entire configuration space, you just can look at a small part and it's enough. So it's an extrapolation technique in some sense. So that's very, very different from other techniques. This one I will skip, and probably this one as well. Just these are all data where we could just compare with the numerical orientation group and see that everything was fine. And I will also skip this one. That was in between Monte Carlo and TCI, we had, at some point we were using low discrepancy sequence integration, which was kind of nice, better than Monte Carlo, but it was really for us a trampoline to get to where we are now. So these are the data that we get for the Coulomb blockade, I mean the Anderson impurity. And you see here, you see the for the charge, this is the observable is the charge on the dot. And you see the different orders, 0, 1, 2, 4, 8, up to 18 here, versus time. These are the same data on each panel, so just different zooms. You see, if we could go to very low time and look at the numbers here, we start with something at the 10 to the power minus 95, and at the end of the day, you get something of order 1, 1 to 10. And you use the same factorization to get so many different orders of variable of magnitude. And you can identify 3 regimes. So you have the asymptotic regime here, where the series has a finite radius of convergence. And this one I will not discuss today, but that was what we were doing before. We were just focusing here. There is some sort of transient regime here, and there is a perturbative regime there. So what we will do is we just stick at a given time, and then there is some of the coefficients will be already converge, but some will be still transient, and some will be perturbative. And because of the perturbative one, we will have actually now an infinite radius of convergence. And you can compute observables. So this is a charge versus U. Now there is no resummation at all, just direct things. And you have a better on that just to make sure that we are doing things the way we correctly. You get here same thing versus time for different value of U. And there are not so many techniques that give you the how evolution of after a quench for an interacting problem. You know, you don't throw away anything here, it's really converged. There is this regime here which we don't yet understand very well, but this is really when Coulomb blockades start to play a role and it affects the dynamics, and it's something we are trying to understand now. Those are the typical Coulomb blockade staircase. So charge versus gate voltage. And you see when you have low large interaction, you get something like zero charge and then a plateau at one charge per on the dot, 0.5 because you have to multiply by 2 for spin, and then eventually 2 charges. And so you can really get all these things. And actually the same data give you all the values for all interaction because you have the series, so you can calculate for all of them. And so before we could get really only a very small fraction of this thing. Very quickly we were in the sign problem territory and we could not get the full thing. So that's really what enlarged our view. On my last slide is the following. Now it's current, so conductance actually versus bias voltage and gate voltage. And I put just an experiment. There are many, many experiments that observe the Condor Ridge. This is one by Takis Kontos group on carbon nanotubes. So you see here the typical Condor Ridge in between. So when you have just an odd number of electrons, you have this Condor resonance that form with Coulomb blockade diamonds here, and we can really reproduce this in totally controlled way. This is essentially exact up to the accuracy that we can give you. And so we are very happy to reach this state. These are very, very fresh. So we didn't check every single the coefficient and stuff, but essentially we can really get to the point where we can predict stuff and compare directly to the experiment in regime of parameter where it's relevant. So we are pretty happy. So that's essentially it for today. That's my conclusion. So okay, you can try these things for tons of applications, and honestly, it's very. So we have an open source code which is coming up. It should get out in a couple of months. I mean, it's almost ready, but still, we need to write the paper and not totally finish. But you can even write your own. It's relatively easy if you follow the paper. There are a couple of tricks, but we explain very clearly. And it's very generic, and I think it will actually be a big changer in the game of essentially making all this MPS, MPO technology useful for tons of things. There are already a few papers, for instance, some people started to use MPO, MPS for solving turbulence or plasma problems, so it's already a few papers started to get out of the usual many-body context. But now we have a really great tool to do that in a systematic way. And I will stop there, and just thanks for your attention.
Hey, thanks a lot. We have questions.
So I want to ask a nice question about this TCI. So like in this procedure, you use like the inverse of the matrix, and I wonder like does this inverse always exist?
Sorry,
this TCI.
The inverse. So you ask about the inverse?
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, no. And the more pivots you add, the more singular become your matrix. So that was just me making a shortcut to make the presentation shorter. And we never calculate the matrix, the inverse. So what you do actually is we have several ways to do that. But now we do partial rank revealing LU decomposition of the T tensor. So you can get these things without actually ever computing the inverse explicitly.
Thank you for a great talk. I was wondering, so all of the or at least most of the results that you showed for real-time dynamics were perturbative in nature. So you go up to some order in Feynman diagrams and you calculate the results. So I was wondering, given the last comment that you made that a bunch of people have been using these sort of ideas to essentially solve partial differential equations in very many dimensions, is there a chance of using some of these ideas to do non-perturbative calculations of dynamics?
Oh, sure. It's open. We started this way, and the reason I'm interested in that is because most of what people do for many-body physics, they are interested in problems that are boring if you remove the interaction. Like let's take the Hubbard model. I mean, without the interaction, it's really I'd get to sleep immediately. I'm a quantum nanoelectronic guy. My problems are already very interesting without interaction. So I'm interested in seeing how things evolve when I switch on the correlations, on how it changes the picture, how I get decoherent, how I get this and this and that. But the technique per se, I mean, we have one paper when we started to develop hybridization technique it seems to work very well. Even this is actually not perturbative in the sense that the series is converging. It has infinite radius of convergence. So if you just add more orders, you can get to any time. And the question is about the physics. If you want to go to very large time, then you need more orders. But it's not necessarily perturbative. I mean, we are calculating 20 orders, and essentially the physics is there. I mean, if you don't have all the processes by the time you get to order 20, then I don't know what's going on in order 21. But there could be many other things, many other ways of using it. It's just, I think we will see a lot of things coming in the next few years.
More questions over there.
Thanks for the interesting talk. I was wondering if you can talk a bit more about this, like a broader perspective with your method versus Monte Carlo comparison. Like these are some interesting specific cases, but do you have already feeling for like more general guideline, like what should work better when?
Well, the the idea to get an intuitive idea of when it will work and when it will not work, essentially, you have a function of many variables. If what your variable is doing depends a lot on all the other variables, it's not going to work. It will work very well when one variable is tied up to, let's say, a couple of neighbors, maybe a bit second neighbors. But so if there is some sort of locality in this tensor train, and that's really in the same sense that MPS for when you do MPS for DMRG, you need low entanglement. And the entanglement in our case is correspond to the bond dimension, and it corresponds to my variable not talking too much to each other. Mm-hmm. So if you're in this case, then this will work like a charm. If not, you will have to push the bond dimension. But we tried for low dimensional. When I say low dimensional, I mean 5D. We tried to break it. We could not. We did the most crazy function we could think of. Now, this is really hard. And five, order 5, we managed to get the integral always. Order 10, then it will depend on the nature of your integral. Monte Carlo always works some sense. For Monte Carlo to work, you need you need important sampling to work. So you need your things to be reasonably sharp to happen in some corner of your configuration space. Mm-hmm. And it could be combined also. We could mm-hmm. do integration of some variables with this and sample the rest. It's up to our creativity to invent how to do these things.
Thank you.
So thank you for the talk. I'm curious on an MPS in a physical many-body system, the order of the spins is obvious, right? But here we have the integration parameters and how they are correlative. They are like how we align them on a line is not obvious, yeah. Right?
It's an open problem in general. In our case, for these Feynman diagrams, you essentially, that's also a part I skipped to make the picture simple, but we want to work in the simplex, so not on the hypercube, but actually the times are ordered. There is always these time ordering operators. So we actually, the times are ordered, T1 smaller than T2, smaller than T3, smaller than T4. And so we actually work with the difference between times. That's our input. And we put them together in this thing. And that's one of the reasons it works. And if you do it badly, for instance, if you really don't care about time ordering, then you see a flat line. You don't have a decrease of your error at all. And so it's important that it's on you. Yeah, no general answer. Just you need to understand what your object and maybe plot it and try to see what are the.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? If not, then I think we can continue with a lunch break. And before this, we will thank Xavier again.